the companies. So Marianne has a draft working agenda. I am sure that anybody who wants it could, who doesn't already have it, who wants to see it, just send me an email and I'll forward it to you. They also are looking at, there were several other factors from the state water plan that they're tasked to look at, one of which was the focusing on perhaps changing the language around indoor water fixtures to promote the use of more water efficient fixtures. We saw two versions of the proposed language. One focused more on perhaps changing legislation. The other focused more on changing regulations. Part of the discussion was, as probably most of you on this call know, regulations are very difficult to change in Connecticut. So what we're going to do is Dave Radka is drawing up a summary of the two versions in our discussion, which we will present to the Water Planning Council and have them weigh in on how they think it's the best way to handle this. And once they have given us some guidance on that, we will include the Department of Consumer Protection in the discussions as well. One point that was brought up was that we do need to keep in our minds the fact that lowering water demands does have some effect not only on perhaps the financial stability of a country, but also the infrastructure because of less water in the pipes. And there are various consequences to that that we just need to be aware of as decisions are made how to move forward. In terms of the topical sub-work groups, we heard from the people looking at the drought plan and how it may or may have been helpful in the 2016-2017 drought. That group is summarizing their recommendations using a consensus-based approach and are shooting to have their draft report completed by the end of December. They did want to give a shout out to the State Interagency Drought Work Group, which has been meeting very much more frequently and with good attendance, looking at the drought that we've been having this summer. So some of the recommendations that they were planning to make was to do exactly that. And so they are pleased that the Interagency Drought Work Group has stepped up and is working very productively. In terms of the domestic wells group, the original group, the white paper that they produced has been forwarded to the Water Planning Council. They hopefully will have a chance to study it before their meeting in November, which is on Election Day. And we will certainly benefit from the discussion and the report back that they will give us after having had a chance to look at it. Alicia, do you want me to mention the thing about the advisory group's review of stuff coming out of the implementation work group here or somewhere else on the agenda?
We'll bring that up under new business.
Okay. The new water quality of domestic wells has met once, and they are discussing the scope of their work and who else would be important to include on that group. And they are scheduling their next meeting for October 26th, and we'll be meeting monthly after that. The outreach and education topical sub-work group, what's today's date, met on the 14th, and they also are better defining their scope of work and reaching out to other organizations as possible participants. We also, as you know, have a proposal for a topical sub-work group on regionalization interconnections. There was discussion of that several months ago in the Water Planning Council, and they asked that we include wastewater as part of that discussion. And we sent them a second proposal that did include wastewater. And they are discussing it, and hopefully will give us more guidance on that at their next meeting. Cycling back to the discussion of the rates work group, We did have a suggestion that the panel should include somebody that represents consumers, such as somebody from the Office of Consumer Counsel. And so that's something that we will be considering. So I think that's it. Questions? Other comments from other people who participated in that meeting? Okay.
Thank you, Virginia. I just want to note that I forgot to hit record until right as your report started. So just for the sake of what's missed in this recording, we approved the minutes of the September 15th meeting. It was unanimous with one abstention by Josh because he wasn't here. So the only thing missing out of the recording is that approval as well as introduction. So I apologize for, that's what I get for not making myself the hit record sticky note, sticking it on my computer. I usually do that before every meeting. Thank you, Virginia. Do we have, are there any other state water planning council or state water plan matters that are not on the agenda that anybody wants to bring up?
Alicia, yeah, I would like to touch base on the state water plan and the governor's council on climate change. There doesn't really seem to be anyone totally focused on how these overlap. And there's some really good recommendations, as you know, coming out of the governor's council on climate change. And I think so that there's not overlap of work or so that it can be coordinated, there needs to be some type of thought or coordination, particularly with the State Water Plan Implementation Committee. So I'm putting that out there on how this should be handled and how it's envisioned, because, for example, under the public health session, there was a section there. It had David Murphy, who helped write the whole state water plan, was leading one of the sessions on public health and resiliency and dealing with water and some other issues, not just drought and whatever. It was multiple issues, but definitely water supply was one of them. So you have that going on. So he's intimately involved with the state water plan and knows about that. But how then does the work that he's doing helping inform the GC3 and the work there, relate to what we're doing on the State Water Implementation Group. So I just wanted to bring that up. I see it as something that we need to at least somehow, figure out. And it may be that as the water reports, the sections of the Governor's Council on Climate Change report comes together, they need to at least, have a discussion with the folks with the state water plan. So, I'm not sure exactly how it should happen, but it's interesting right now because, like I said, there's a lot of good recommendations, and if all of a sudden the Governor's Council on Climate Change sees a priority, goes in that direction, and the state water plan folks or implementation work group are going in another direction, it would be good if we were actually deciding what the priorities were and going in the same direction. So just putting that out there.
I agree, Denise. I at least for the rivers work, particularly with the conservation section of our recommendations, we did call out the fact that almost every distinct recommendation we had put forward is something that the implementation work group is currently working on. And if the state wants to get bang for their buck, they really should invest in implementing consensus recommendations on the state water plan. And that was one of our specific recommendations. I haven't looked to see how some of the other groups have matched up some of their recommendations with not just the state water plan, but, the law of the plan of conservation and development, the green plan. In the governor's order, there were marching orders for the various entities that are in charge of the state plans to go through and look at the GC three recommendations and see how they match up with the recommendations of the GC three. It felt a little backwards to me. I guess you can look at it both ways. I always thought that the different groups should probably be looking at their plans and putting forth the specific recommendations that they have that that pertain to climate change, so they could be included in the reports specifically from these plans and to have them specifically referenced. So so that, according to the governor's order, executive order, the groups are supposed to be done with that by 2021, the end of 2021. So, but go ahead, Virginia.
As you said, a lot of the ideas and recommendations from all these various groups align fairly readily because the issues are fairly clearly understood. If that is not the case, who trumps what? Who rules? Which has the greater force in terms of the implementation of it? Is the governor's order and this GC3 stuff take precedence, or does the water plan approved by the legislature take precedence?
That's a good question, Virginia. And that's why I always felt that the entities that were responsible for the planning documents should have been the other way around. They should have brought their consensus recommendations forward to be included in the Governor's Council on Climate Change, because obviously those plans have already gone through the public process and a stakeholder process. So
Is there an explicit implementation plan for the climate change work that's been done? It's been so long since I've read that order, I don't recall.
So a lot of the
Go ahead, Denise.
Anybody else know? Well, I was saying a lot of the recommendations that I have seen coming out of the GC3 are very specific recommendations. So it's not a plan with a planning goal per se. There are some. So they're all over the place. Some of them are more general, but some of them are very, very specific. You know, change this law or do this type of thing or whatever. So that's where, you know, I just think that there needs to be some type of coordination. And it's one of the things that I have found, and we kind of know this with water anyway, as water has a lot of silos. You know, because there's just so many pieces. Is it fresh water? Is it marine water? Is it, you know, are we talking about groundwater? So just the resource itself, but then also, you know, are we talking about impaired waters? Are we talking about source water protection? You know, let's just say there's a lot of silos with people with different jobs. And one of the things I'm seeing is that so you have the wetlands group, you have the rivers group, but then you have all of these adaptation groups. So the public health group, that's the adaptation group, is looking at how drought is tackled, as well as the rivers group. So even within the GC3, not all of the water recommendations are consolidated. So one of the things I'm looking at is, okay, so then how does that fit in with the state water plan as well as some of the other plans? But the idea is that eventually we have to get to some type of comprehensive water strategy, because we're always pulling and tugging at each other that way. And one of the things I noted, for example, just the way the working and natural lands groups were set up, is they were being staffed by DEP, who were primarily out of the natural resource section, which is very habitat, wildlife driven staff, versus folks who are the water staff. Differently in the public health adaptation piece, they've got people who are, you know, looking at, okay, what is the Department of Public Health, what are their concerns with water, you know, particularly related to drought or water quality. So like I'm saying, if the particular focus of the work group didn't pick up on some of these water aspects that are important to climate change. I think we're missing something that we need to pay attention. And certainly the state water plan talks about that it needs to be informed and be fluid in its response to climate change, because we don't really know what all the changes are going to be and how we're going to be impacted. So I think that there's kind of this overlap. And I'm not saying that you stop one process because of another process. I'm just saying, how do we make sure? So, for example, should the state water plan work group, should one of the things be doing is like, hey, all of these reports are out there. Should we be looking not to necessarily comment on the reports, which the comments are due tomorrow, but to say, okay, here's where they are. There's going to be some changes made, but by January, how do we as a state, you know, because we're working with the agencies who are putting this together, how do we make sure that whatever comes out in January sets the stage for further work in 2021 that really makes sure that all of these are aligned, so that it's not going to happen right now, but that we don't keep moving forward with these silos and we start making sure that everything is meshed together. And I have to say, I don't see that right now. And I see some pieces missing, because I don't see anybody really, with the exception of the public health, and public health is looking primarily at drinking water supply watersheds. So you have all the other watersheds to look at. No one's really looking at the water quality aspect except for the rivers group. But like I said, they weren't necessarily, you know, if Alicia wasn't in charge of that group, there may not have been as much focus even on water quality there. So I'm just putting it out there. Like, and then how does it relate to the state water plan as well as other planning efforts? So I just see there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
And I'm bringing up, Denise, I'm bringing up the, trying to find the governor's executive order, because there was a second step in this. Like I said, you know, I didn't necessarily agree where it came in the process, because like Virginia said, if there's a recommendation in the report, how does that impact the state water plan? But I think what we need to do at this point is come back to the Water Planning Council at their next meeting, remind them that there is this check in the to-do list of GC3 for the Water Planning Council. I can't find it right now, I'm sorry. But I can't find the exact wording. But remind them that this needs to get done and that we need to make a plan, whether it's a advisory group, work group, or an implementation work group that will come up with taking the GC3 report and reconciling it with the climate change recommendations in the state water plan, or even just some of the recommendations outside of climate change that come along with the GC3 report. So there does need to be some sort of reconciliation there. And then looking at, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not the only report that needs to be reconciled, right? I mean, Chad had this about a year ago, all the other reports that exist out there. Margaret and I think you talked about this at one point, the wildlife plan and all that, but this is obviously more directly pertinent. So someone needs to reconcile the two reports, you know, and make sure that there's not a recommendation that's contrary or inconsistent with the state water plan. And maybe there's something in one report that should be changed in another, right, or not. So I agree with you that something needs to be done, but I think there's other reports as well that could be reconciled. And I think Margaret had a nice long list she sent me, and I started reading them. And unfortunately, a lot of these reports are not directive. They're conceptual or planning level. It's very hard to compare planning level reports against planning level reports because there's no specific recommendations. That's one of the biggest challenges I started looking at that.
So. I think we should just put out there that we need a process for reconciling any discrepancies that might exist between any of the reports that we have. And as those of you who have known me for a long time know, I'm not very regulated by officialdom. And I would hope that even if it were determined which report, which set of recommendations were deemed to be more significant, that that wouldn't be you, that if there's a good idea out there, that it wouldn't be shut down just because it doesn't follow the recommendations of the of whichever set is supposed to be the leading recommendations, that good ideas would be considered regardless of that, and that it not be used as an excuse to not move forward on a particular issue.
And let's not forget, we should be doing an update in the state water plan about 3 years from now. So.
Yeah, and I think the point being is that when we're looking at climate change, there's an urgency and there's some very good data that's being gathered as part of this. So some of the recommendations, for example, in the governor's climate change report is going to be saying, we need more data on this. We need more data on that. And that's where we're saying the same thing for the state water plan, that we need more data to make some good decisions moving forward. So that's where, is it just data we need, or is it applicable to the climate change? So I'm looking at not just reconciling differences, but how do we forward the agenda of the state water plan in the Governor's Council climate change report where appropriate? You know, what are the components of the state water plan that are really, really important, you know, when we're, especially when we're talking about quantity of water, when we're talking about changes in precipitation rates, not necessarily, you know, the fact that we might get more precipitation but have less available to us, but more droughts. You know? So, like, how do we get that informed? And some of the discussions we've been having at the drought work group in terms of what should we use in terms of precipitation rates, and, you know, how should we be setting trigger levels and those types of things. And the GC3 has people who, you know, they're working with CERCLA and they're working with some other folks, and they're determining where we need more data and how we're going to make those decisions. What's the best table or modeling for precipitation rates and those types of things. So I'm just saying there's also advantages to us, those of us working on the state water plan, to kind of making sure that folks understand that, and that, you know, like if they're making a recommendation for new data, it's like, okay, is that going to help us? Or do we need to inform them about what would help us? So I'm just putting it out there that there's a lot of stuff going on, and we certainly should be looking at the recommendations and making sure that not only, like I said, that there's not that there's opposing ones, but how we benefit each other, and is there work of the state water plan that should be pushed ahead through the GC3. And the reason I'm saying that is the GC3 has a lot of momentum, and I think it's going to be an action plan. I don't think it's going to be just a report sitting on the shelf.
Yeah, I agree. And I think if we need to bring this to the Water Planning Council again, a reminder that this is on their checklist of things to do, and not only to do it because just to check off the box, but because, you know, we've been talking for a long time that, you know, implementation needs resources to even just put all of this together. And I think we could certainly make that case with the water plan.
Yeah, and go on to offer your comment. The Governor's Council on Climate Change has a whole committee just looking at funding. How do we get things funded? So, you know, looking at funding and what needs to be funded, that's definitely on our plate. And, you know, if it's something that because of climate change raises, you know, brings up an urgency that we need to be able to do this, I think that could only help us.
Can I just jump in here real quick? This is Gannon. So I found the governor's executive order, and I posted the link in the chat. Folks may want to just take a look at that and see. The governor's council, from the order, one of the responsibilities is to simply update the previous plans and note progress that's been made, and that's a big part of it. The next is assembling the different working groups that we're somewhat familiar with at this point. And then it lists on the back end, and number six, it says, just before then, in section 5C, It says that each state agency member of the Climate Change Adaptation Resiliency Subcommittee shall report to the Council on the alignment of climate change adaptation strategies incorporated into their relevant planning processes and documents. So it mentions several groups. It mentions the State Water Plan, the Water Planning Council. It mentions the Forest Action Plan, the Wildlife Action Plan, the State Building Code. So these agencies and others and plans and other plans not listed are responsible for incorporating the recommendations of the GC3 into their work. So this is probably a really good time to get the council kind of paying attention to what those are, because the public comment period ends tomorrow. And so, you know, the drafts will be coming together after that. So thank you, Denise, for bringing that up. I think it's a really important point and something that we just spend so much time planning and meeting and talking and writing and reading that we don't always bring together all of the different things so that, you know, we can streamline it a bit more.
Okay. Are there, what do you guys see on your screen now? Is it the agenda or the executive order? The agenda? Okay. Sometimes I can't tell exactly what you guys are seeing. Let me just stop sharing, start sharing again so I know where I am. All right. Are there any other, Water Planning Council State Water Plan matters before we move on to old business? Okay. Dan, do you have a WOOC update?
Yes, we do, which is good. Okay. So earlier in the year, prior to COVID starting, we had organized a statewide group to start looking at implementing recommendations from the WOOC plan. Then COVID happened. So we had a really great meeting at NDC, and then COVID happened. And that's been delayed, trying to figure out how to get that going. So November 5th, we're going to reconvene virtually. Right now, I think that the time is in the afternoon. I can get that out to you, Alicia, when we finalize all that, so you can get it distributed. So we'll be reaching out to everybody in the WOOC. And again, that'll be the three WOOCs working together in one combination, establishing, much like in the state water plan, subgroups to handle and start working on various topics. So looking forward to that getting started, so that's where we are.
Are you going to remind those of us that may have volunteered for something in February that we volunteered for something back then?
I do have all those. I had to go back a long way to find those notes. I couldn't believe how long ago that was, and remind myself what we said and put an agenda together that made some sense. So yeah, there's a lot of people that volunteer to probably actually double check everyone's willing still to volunteer, because it's like a whole new life right now. So that'll be good. That's the only update I have right now.
And November 5th is a Thursday. Wow, that was a rough one to say.
Got it out. Good job. Yeah.
It's hard to say without sounding like Elmer Fudd. Anything else on the WOOC?
Nope, not right now.
Bruce, do you want to give the interagency drought worker update?
I can do that. Well, I could do that if I could remember when the group last met, but I think the group met on the 1st of October. And at this point, we have several categories in what is now stage 3 drought, which is the equivalent of stage 2 drought, the second stage of drought under the old drought plan. And there was plenty of news about that back at the time. And I think the key thing for people who don't dig into the data all that often, you might think that there would be massive improvement right now. And of course, stream flows are all up. A lot of water has hit a lot of streams in a hurry, but groundwater has really not budged. And in fact, many of groundwater levels are continuing to decline as if it hadn't rained at all, because there was so much pent up soil dryness and dry vegetation that wicked up a lot of the rain that did fall. So no one should expect a very radical change the next time the group gets together, which I believe will be the first week of November. That's all I have to say. I'm happy to answer any questions people have.
It'll be November 9th.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Can you all see? I've got the drought declaration map here. Can you all see that?
Yes.
Okay, good. This is from the Water Planning Council's drought information site. Again, I know I've shown this before. There's quite a bit of information here. And just to add on to Bruce's report, the stream flows go up for about 24 hours, and then they essentially come back down to just about where they were prior to the rainstorm we've had. But to be honest, I haven't looked at them since last Friday's rain, which in some areas was a really nice soaking rain. So I'm hoping that our streams got more benefit from that rainstorm than they have in some of the previous storms. Anybody else have questions?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Martha. So I did look at the drought messaging, and I'm just wondering if anyone else has, you know, noticed this. There's a disconnect. If someone isn't aware of, you know, the state, the different regions of hydraulics, because the October 5th press release, you know, notes that, you know, the northern part of the state is in stage 3 and some other counties are in stage 2. And it says New Haven and Fairfield counties are stage 1. But then you can see there's also Aquarian posted a notice on October 14th. And they talk about the mandatory irrigation ban in Southwest Fairfield County. And, you know, they said because it hits its third drought trigger this fall. And, you know, if someone doesn't really understand what the difference is between, you know, how a water company decides a drought and how the state interagency water, the drought group figures out a drought, it seems you're getting kind of a mixed message there.
That's something we've been talking about in the drought subwork group. Mm-hmm. In having, you know, maybe a checklist and some templates that go over a lot of these points. You know, I made the suggestion that, you know, in every press release, they should be very specifically saying, you should be looking to your specific supplier to see, you know, to understand their status. And that should be something that and, you know, addressing groundwater, you know, private wells. How people should be thinking or reacting to this if they're on a private well. And I think there is a little bit of this. I didn't read this press release carefully, but it's one of the recommendations that's coming out from the drought subgroup, or at least it's in the, it hasn't made the cut yet. Or I mean, it hasn't been cut yet. So I think it will make the cut.
Okay. That's all I have to say. I just noted that. And it could be confusing.
I have
a question, Mrs. Mary.
Sure.
I'll come out from the woods. So, you know, this drought, I'm from the West, so I've always been concerned about droughts and water quality. But, you know, everybody's like, oh, you know, plenty of water in Connecticut, wahoo. And we're going to have more. It's going to be flooding. That's the big problem. But how much are these GC3 reports, and I realize this isn't the GC3 groups, but, you know, kind of sinking in that drought is going to be part of the problem. Do you know whether any, like the science and technology group seems so focused on sea level rise, you know, is it only this rivers group that's really taking on drought issues, or anyway, that's a question. You may not have the answer.
I have not carefully looked through all of the other work groups' reports. I know the rivers group, we addressed the various solutions that a lot of those are already in the state water plan, and how, you know, our rivers can better prepare us for drought through making sure that, you know, they can naturally, you know, do their own mitigation and adaptation, you know, and not be sort of, you know, hindered by our human alterations. But I'm not sure. I'm sure the public health side has addressed it. And we have, I know we have some other members that have, were on other groups. So I don't know if you want to respond to that.
This is Iris. I in our drought committee, we actually, one of the questions we were talking about is climate change, and was pointed out, the question we pointed out, and I don't have an answer, if the models that we're using are up to date and if they need to be updated because of the climate change, or so we talked about that. So, but I'm not a model person, so I cannot answer to that, but we did.
She's talking specifically about the Governor's Council on Climate Change groups and their report.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
So with the recent rains and stream flows being up, at least temporarily, what has been the effect on reservoir levels?
So I'm not sure if Bruce has seen something new. Unfortunately, the new DPH report is not up on the website. So I don't know if any of the water utility representatives here just want to give a brief overview of how their rain has impacted their supply. Come on, we got a bunch of you here. Nobody, don't you all jump in at once.
I figured out the unmute button, Alicia.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Yeah, so I would say, Fred, minimally, not much. I mean, it's basically maybe holding the line a little bit, but it's really not a lot of rain in the grand scheme of things of the year. You know, and utilities are different. Some have more storage, some have a lot like us. We're still like just below our long-term average because we're living off a wet 2019, because that's how our reservoir system works. Right now, I'd say for us and a lot of utilities, what's really going to be critical is November to May. That's the time we're refilling. So in many cases, a drought in those months is a lot worse than the drought we just had. So time will tell.
Yeah, I agree with John.
I just want to echo the same thing, John, you know, with John and Dan, is that, and we talked about this in the drought work group, is that a lot of the reservoirs this year had a lot of storage, so we didn't see a real lot of problems in the summer in terms of storage, even though we were seeing the, you know, the drought kind of escalate. And of course now, you know, hopefully we'll start seeing like outdoor water use go down and whatever, but there was still a lot of storage. But similarly to the drought we had in 2016 and then through 17, what really set us up was the water, the lack of rain in the winter from 2015 to 2016 really set us up for that 2016 drought. And because if you start looking at the records there, when we started getting into the 2016 drought, we were like at something like a 10-inch deficit of rainfall for the year. So it's exactly what we need to pay attention to, particularly for the larger reservoirs that have storage. If we still continue to have drought, it's going to start impacting, because now it's not 1 year of storage. Now you're looking at 2 years of not getting great storage. So I think we do need to pay attention to that. And I just wanted to answer, I think it was Mary Pelletier, that definitely the GC3 public health folks are looking at that drought. But again, one of the things that I'm hoping that they'll come out with is we do need better modeling, and we need to be asking CERCA and, you know, to be looking and recommending some good models for not necessarily for, you know, rainfall and whatever. A lot of times they've been looking at long-term predictions, like, oh, say they're expecting the annual rainfall to go up by an inch or something like that. Well, that doesn't help us. We you know, for drought predictions, we need to know the distribution of rainfall and, you know, how much runoff we're going to have. So we need a much more complicated model like the utilities are using for them to be talking about the, you know, the impacts of drought in our state. And the impacts, no one's really looking at the impacts of
the trees, you know, leafing out earlier and dropping leaves later in the fall. And some people say, oh, that doesn't impact it at all. And it's like, you know, I think that it really depends on where you are. I think in an area like ours, where we have such, you know, where we're so much forest in our state, that it does impact it, and we need to be paying attention.
And, if I can add to that a little bit, when for doing safe yield modeling of surface water systems, you're generally looking at the worst case drought. And for us, in the last 100 years, that's 3 years in the 1960s, I think 64 through 66. We did a little work with UConn on climate change, and, you know, there's going to be, you know, like everybody says, more extremes on either end. But the bottom line, I think, UConn concluded that there's probably the 60s drought is still a pretty good one to plan around as far as precipitation. But one of the keys that one of the things that may be looked at is evaporation, because that's definitely something that's going to change. And so, you know, even though we're probably going to net more rainfall in the future, if the models are correct, it may not result in necessarily more storage because of the evaporation factor.
Okay, is there anything else? Any other questions on the Interagency Drought Work Group before we move on to the nominating committee? I just want to add before we move off this subject, I did sit in on the last meeting they had in early October. This is the first one I've actually sat in on, although I've been checking on the agendas, minutes, and all of the handouts that they've sent. And I have to say, I really appreciate how systematic they are about going through their decision-making process. It's very orderly, process-oriented, and systematic. So, you know, but still leaving room for professional judgment. They seem to be doing an excellent job. So, and also, I just want to mention there's a, in addition to the Interagency Drought Work Group, there is a, oh, Bruce, help me, what are they calling? There's not an action team. There's another work group. Go ahead.
I was just going to say they changed their name. I don't participate in that group. It was an action team, and then it became something else. I think it may, oh, I forget, but I think they changed their name, but it's a small group intended to be, instead of three or four people per agency, maybe one person per agency to take small tasks and try to work them out on a very prompt basis.
Right. So they're taking with the decisions and the actions that the Interagency Drought Group Work Group has decided to take, and in carrying out a lot of the steps in the state drought preparedness plan, they, outside of these Interagency Drought Work Group, they take action on these things and decide how to do that. So, you know, there's no decision making being done there. They're just the ones that are there making sure that these tasks get done. So. It's good to see progress on this. So I don't think we really have any updates on the nominating committee, do we, John? We don't have any updates there, except that. Karen, I'm sorry I didn't give you a heads up on this, but I don't think the advisory group knows that your alternate, the news on your alternate. Karen, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Due to the unfortunate passing of Melissa Schlag, who has been my alternate and been involved, not tremendously in this group, but she has been involved with many water projects, my new alternate will be Catherine Fiedler, Kat Fiedler from Save the Sound.
And I apologize. I probably should have had this announcement made at the beginning that we had let the Water Planning Council know. Melissa passed away the end of September or very early October. And she was young, she was amazing, and she will be very much missed by the water community. So there are many of us who knew her and respected her and loved her. So
very, very well said. Alicia, very well said. She will be missed tremendously.
Alicia?
Yes, go ahead.
I think it would be worth redistributing the nominating slate, and as such also reminding people of what categories of participants we have. There were several of us who were sort of vague on what category we were representing, and I think if we took a look at that, we would be reminded of those categories.
Sure.
Is that an active link in the agenda, Alicia?
Yep. Yes. Okay. There is an active link in the agenda, so you can go ahead and
oh, okay. Thank you.
This is Bruce. I just want to point out that Active Link is not the most recently updated version. It does not include the new alternate for Karen. I think it's set to be determined.
So we'll make sure that the newest version is up before the next. With that small detail, you can continue to use this, understanding that small detail that Kat is now the alternate for Karen. But you can go ahead and use this until we post the next one. And we'll put that link in the next agenda.
Alicia, I think we should add that the Water Planning Council did not approve the slate yet. They tabled it till the November meeting.
Yes. All right, Karen, do you want to give an update on the Watershed Lands Group?
Sure. We had a very good meeting last Friday, very well attended by advisory group members, water companies, agency staff, solar developers, environmental organizations. It was very well attended, and Peter Hearn of CEQ gave a very, very informative presentation. And that has left us with a lot more discussion items on our plate. Just so the group is aware, some of the things that came up after and during Peter's discussion and presentation. And by the way, if anyone on this group did not get his presentation or the slide presentation, please let me know or let Alicia know and you will get it. It's a very good PowerPoint. My notes don't do it justice, but it's, I think, very informative. Some of the open issues, and it was kind of like almost deja vu when we found out that CEQ was told us that on the form that they are given to review siting projects for the Siting Council, it does not include information on whether the property where the solar installation is being requested is in aquifer protection or source protection land. So that it kind of reminded me of the Cheshire Land Conveyance form. Also came up, which was very interesting, was that one of the solar developers suggested that DEEP develop a list of preferred sites where they would like to see or think solar projects should go, and that's done in several counties in Virginia, and I'm sorry, in Vermont. That was very interesting. DEEP did say it promoted brownfields and rooftops and developed areas, but that was a very another interesting point that came up from the developer. Another question came up that there is a legislation, PA 217-218, regarding solar projects. And one of their, and it says that they may not be put in core forests. And there was quite a bit of discussion on the fact that, well, it's not just core forests, it's all forests, and should watershed land be in that not. So further discussion there. And a general need for more public involvement, public knowledge of not only the projects, but of the process, and of a need for all parties to get together and look at moving forward or moving, you know, developing a better path forward. And, you know, just as kind of a closing on that, this kind of just rolls right into or adds to the Watershed Lands Work Group. Earlier discussions with DPH on solar projects on watershed land, and the issue of water and the nexus of energy and water is very important, and I think it's something that we will have to follow closely. So what Margaret and I have said that we would do is we will come up with some dates, send it to agency staff, Bruce, Eric, and set out another doodle poll and hold another meeting so we can further discussion, have further discussions on these topics. So it was a very good meeting.
John, would you mind giving a brief update on where the Gaylord project stands right now?
Yeah, the 360 Gaylord Mountain Road project is in Hamden, and it's a solar array proposed by, I think, an LLC on forest land that's part of the Lake Whitney watershed, an RWA reservoir, and proposes clear cutting of 12 acres of forest on that land. The RWA has intervened on the application, and we were granted that status at their October meeting. On November 17th, there's an evidentiary hearing at 2 p.m. and a public hearing at 6 p.m., both of which will be held remotely.
What was that date again, John? I'm sorry.
November 17th.
Thank you.
And if you want to, you know, see any of the filings, it's all on the Siting Council's website. Google 360 Gaylord Mountain Road. You'll find it.
Does anybody have any questions for Karen or John?
This is Fred. Not really a question, but I do very much appreciate the opportunity to have the energy industry, and particularly the solar industry, participate in that last meeting. And we look forward to continuing that participation. As you know, Noel Lafayette, who is a solar developer, mentioned, we all agree on the need to safeguard all of our natural resources, whether they be air, water, or land. And particularly, I think that, this is very important to the solar industry because solar displaces fossil fuel-fired generating plants. So it reduces greenhouse gases, but it also reduces the use of cooling water that's needed to cool fossil-fired generating plants. And it also reduces the use of landfills that are needed to bury the hazardous waste byproducts. I just want to mention and highlight a few of the things that were discussed, which is, some of the alternative locations for solar. There's rooftop, but that's no panacea because, as Noel mentioned, you have to look at the age of the roof. Can it bear the weight? Does it need to be replaced? So you'd have to remove the solar and then put it back. The size. Who owns the roof? Many times buildings are owned by lessees. And so, the owner can't necessarily put solar on the roof, or the lessee can't necessarily put solar on the roof. And then is the ability to use the energy that's generated, or does it have to go back to the grid, which is an issue. Very briefly, some people like canopies, the solar canopies on parking lots, but a lot of people don't. So there are a lot of local zoning issues and land use issues that are in opposition to that, plus they're expensive. Landfills are a great idea as long as they're mature landfills and they've been kept for 20 plus years, because otherwise if they're not mature and you start putting in pilings, they can pierce the cap and create their own environmental issues. And then there's land mount, and we did, I think, articulate that the Siting Council is very much an environmental agency. That is their charge, and they look at a whole list of environmental issues, including particularly stormwater runoff. And I know that I cited a few recent cases where the Siting Council denied petitions for land mount, ground mount solar, due in large part because of inadequate protection from stormwater runoff. So I just wanted to mention that. And again, thank Karen, and we look forward to a more detailed discussion as we get into the issues as the group meets again.
Thank you, Fred. Is there anyone else?
Hi, Alicia. Let's see. Yeah, I wanted to make sure I was on mute, wasn't on mute. The Governor's Council on Climate Change, again, is really looking at this. And there's a couple of items that come up that I think are really important to this discussion. And that has to do with, you know, whenever we're dealing with environmental considerations, there's always a balance. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Learned that very early on in working in environmental protection. So we always have to balance this. And one of the challenges that we've seen, and this is very well documented in the CEQ report, is that when they just looked at the cost and when they put out the RFP for large-scale solar so that people could, you know, apply and get the benefits, and the state was helping incentivize this through different programs, they looked at costs, but they only looked purely at direct installation costs. And with some, as someone who has a degree in environmental economics, that's exactly what we don't do. If you don't look at the external costs, then you're not really weighing the cost and benefits of what you're doing. So you're really not looking at the whole picture. So for example, if you're only looking at the cost of installation in terms of the direct cost of installation, obviously, you're going to be directed to forest land, you're going to be directed to farmland where there's not a lot of work to be done. But if you don't look at the external cost, the benefit lost of watershed protection, the loss of prime agricultural soils for food production, if you don't look at those external costs, then you're not looking at the true cost of solar installation. So when you start adding in those external costs, and that's one of the things we're looking at and that the recommendation is, and I think the Working in Natural Lands group of the GC3 is really trying to, you know, hammer that home, is that you don't just lose some trees and a little bit of habitat. You're losing a real ecosystem services from carbon sequestration, carbon storage, to water quality renovation. So there's a whole host of benefits of forest to temperature modification in terms of, you know, addressing climate change and adapting to climate change, resiliency of our forests. So the idea of, for example, if you've got the GC3 right now saying, you know, one of the major recommendations is no net loss of forest, certainly we can't then be looking at, we should be cutting down forests to do solar installation. So I think that some of these recommendations are really good that are coming out there. And one of the key considerations that I think we should be really looking at is that we need to do an economic analysis that includes the externalities, not just direct costs of installation of a project when we're looking at a cost-benefit analysis, because we're really shortchanging ourselves. It's microeconomics versus macroeconomics. And when we're talking about public drinking water supply and some other issues, and when we're looking at renewable energy and an energy policy, then we need to look at the whole picture. So I think that there's some really good balances there that need to be looked at. But we understand why folks who are looking to invest, they are looking just at direct cost of installation. But we really need to look at bigger than that. And the other thing is that by directing, there's a big focus on environmental justice and equity. And so one of the things, for example, when they first came out with the first RFP, there was not one solar application that was directed towards the inner city. So basically, from a solar installation perspective, the benefits are all going to the suburbs and outside. There's no solar activity happening. We basically don't have any solar activity in the cities. basically denying the folks who are, you know, the most vulnerable to being able to take advantage of solar. And there's a whole host of solar advantages for them in the city, not and particularly from a cost, but there's other advantages as well. So a lot of this is in the GC3 report that you're going to be see coming out. But to bring this back to water and the role of this group, I think that from the Siting Council's perspective, to not have an application or an applicant state on their application that they're in a public drinking water supply watershed is a huge oversight, and that should not be. So I think the guidance that they're looking at needs to say what watershed they're in, and it needs to say if they're in a public drinking water supply watershed. So we really need to look at that guidance and update that, because, you know, to not even have that required and therefore to be no mention that it's in a public drinking water supply watershed in an application is something that is just untenable. I worked in a municipal land use agency. I was the key staff person looking at these types of things, environmental impacts on every planning and zoning application in the town of Greenwich. And we had a lot of applications coming through, and we always was, you know, we had on our application, is it in a public drinking water supply watershed, for the Siting Council not to ask for that information? I just think it's outrageous. And I actually think the Water Planning Council should weigh in on it, because this should not be. They're the state agency. DEEP should not, that has an oversight in PURA and sits on PURA, should not be allowing this. So I think it's really, really important from a water quality perspective.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to, you know, getting deeper into these issues and continuing the discussion. I appreciate, you know, your comments. I think that something that's very important that you need to consider is that these RFPs, first of all, they're only one step in the development of a number of projects. They're one funding mechanism, and that there are other funding mechanisms. But even if a particular project or developer wins an RFP, they still have to get their general permit or specific permit from DEEP. They still have to go to the Siting Council. So, you know, really the RFP only looks at the dollars, and you then have to go through other steps in order to get approved and cited. And those other steps take environmental considerations very, very seriously.
I don't think the declaratory ruling application, it takes it as seriously as it should, unless someone really asks for a public hearing. Basically, they go in, they present their case, and unless somebody like the water utility comes in and makes a case, or you have a municipality come in and make the case, it doesn't even have to go to a public hearing. So a declaratory ruling is basically saying that as long as you submitted based on this guidance. And that's my problem with the declaratory ruling. They're doing a declaratory ruling based on the guidance they put together. The guidance doesn't even ask if it's in a public drinking water supply watershed. That should not be acceptable for a declaratory ruling. If the Siting Council is making the case that they're going to do a declaratory ruling based on what's presented to them, and someone doesn't bring up that it's in a public drinking water supply watershed, they're not taking into consideration. And I will tell you, the utility was on top of this and understood this. One of the municipalities that was involved and submitted document, they didn't even mention. And a lot of the information that was first came in when this was first out there didn't mention it was in a public drinking water supply, because they didn't know, because they were just looking at the application. So I think it's important to ask for the right information if you're going to be using a declaratory ruling process at the Siting Council. Then you need to ask for the right information, and in my opinion, they're not. And that's coming from 30 years of working in a land use regulatory agency.
Again,
so I think that this is something that we need to hash out in the watershed plans committee, because it sounds like this is something that the group should really hone out get the stakeholders together to make these recommendations to the Siting Council to try to find a better process for this, similar to what we've done with the Cheshire Lands issue in recommending that a process for which the decision makers can have this information. So if we can continue this discussion in committee to work out the details, that would be wonderful.
Yes, Alicia, just one comment. And for those of you who were not at the meeting, you're getting a good flavor of the discussion at the meeting. And I would like you to know that the meeting was recorded. So Alicia, if you can, if anyone wants to hear it, you've got an hour and a half or so or more. Alicia, we use Alicia Zoom and it has been recorded. So you find it interesting.
And I'll see where I think Eric had posted or sent out an email with a link. So I'll find that link and get it out.
If I may also add that Denise's comment, I mean, about the an assessment, a financial assessment of the ecosystem service benefits ought to be done accurately, and a full analysis of the economic issues. I just found it hard to believe from that summary report that, and I was glad that Denise spoke up, because I will be listening to that program to find out why people are against solar arrays in parking lots. I've yet to hear anybody say that other than people who don't want to install there.
Okay, so I'm sorry, go ahead, Fred.
No, there are a number of people that would love to install them in parking lots, and they've been denied at the local level. And they are much more expensive. So there's a lot of considerations, and there are a lot of different steps in the review that I think we're not getting into here. And again, I welcome the opportunity to get into that in the working group, so that the working group sees all of these issues. Because I'm reading the comments here and I'm listening to Denise, and with all due respect, there's a lot more detail that we need to get into.
Okay, Margaret, and then I'd like Karen to just give people some direction on how they can get on the list when the Watershed Lands Group meets again. Go ahead, Margaret.
Yes, thank you very much. Apologies for being late. I've been seconding information. I've been on the chat seconding particularly Denise's comments and yours and Karen's. We do need to follow up quickly. I don't know why Fred Klein thinks that we don't have a good experience with siting solar projects. I used to be a member of, I think it's called, Solar Connecticut with Peter Millman and Scully. We've worked on solar projects. I've seen them. We're not coming to this without information. So I just wanted you to know many of the things issues that you raise are things that we've heard about, we've looked at. We might not agree on your interpretation, but we're aware of the factors.
That's okay, Alicia, just to let you know, Eric Lindquist of OPM sends out all of the notices for our meetings. If you have his email, you can just zap it to him and he will get you on. If not, just send me or Alicia or Bruce Witchen and a little note and Josh that you would like to be on the Watershed Lands Work Group mailing list, and we will get that to Eric, and the next thing you should probably be getting from us will be, and this might not be till after the election, but a doodle poll to find to set up a date and time of our next meeting.
Okay, I'm putting Eric's email in the chat. See, I'm not on mute. So go ahead and copy and paste that. Send Eric an email with the subject line, add to Watershed Lands Group distribution list, and just ask that he adds your email to the distribution list. I'm having a very difficult time talking today.
Alicia, before you go off this, I just wanted to let people know I posted in the chat a workshop that the Connecticut Sierra Club is holding on power to the people, and it's discussing centralized large-scale solar versus distributed generation, and why there's what are the barriers are to distributed generation and why it's not being embraced in Connecticut in terms of getting towards a modern grid. So just wanted to put that out there that people may want to take a look at that workshop.
Okay, thank you, Denise. I really want to move on. There's a couple of things that under new business that I want to bring up. So there's no updates on the conservation pricing and rate recovery analysis at this point. I'm still waiting to get together with Jack Lukowski and Lori Matthew, as they wanted to have a further discussion with me about the proposal we put forth on the utility merger analysis work group. So hopefully we'll have something to bring back to you guys by the next meeting as to what their thoughts were. Actually, what will happen is after we have our discussion, it will probably go back to the Water Planning Council for them to weigh in, and then we'll probably get kicked back down to us. So hopefully we can get started on that in the beginning of the year. There are no other work updates unless I'm missing something. Anything before I move on to new business? Okay, so I wanted to bring up here, Virginia had brought up at the implementation work group meeting how the Water Planning Advisory Group makes recommendations to the implementation work group on work products such as reports. The report that we had reviewed was the private wells white paper. We got two responses back. We sent those along as individual responses, and the implementation work group would like us to send responses as an advisory group. So going forward, we will be sending those back, which means that you'll all need to take a look at what others have commented on as far as the products go, and then we have to agree that this is how the entire group feels before we send it back to the implementation group. So are there any thoughts, discussion on this? Do you want to add anything, Virginia?
Just briefly, we would really like sort of a consensus response from the advisory group. And it would be particularly important if there were many individuals who had comments. Also, it would be important if the individuals who had comments contradicted each other. And let me emphasize, it did not happen with the two responses that we got for the groundwater white paper, the domestic well white paper. But let's say that somebody had made a, off the wall kind of a comment, and that the rest of the advisory group may have disagreed with. We certainly want to know that the advisory group, which does represent a broad spectrum of interests, we would like to know, as I said, the consensus of that broader spectrum.
So under this framework, you would have consensus recommendations from the group, but you would also have individual responses from members if they want to comment?
Philosophically, I would say yes. Of course, I always would like to hear the other responses. In the extreme, that would defeat the whole purpose of having a consensus response, because if there was a consensus document and then, okay, these seven people had their own things that they want you to consider, it, so I'm hedging here because I can argue both sides of this.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking back to the state water plan process, and I think we did have both. We had, this, it might have been Kirk Westfall's spreadsheet or something, but I think I can recall there were some comments the advisory group had that we all got around a table and said, this is what we want to put out. But still those individual comments out there to for the authors to consider.
Yeah.
We certainly would not. We can't stop anybody from giving their input, and so I guess I would say yes. I'd like to see a consensus response from the group, but if there are individuals that the group thought needed also to have the opportunity to express their opinion, that those would be sent along as well.
Okay. Virginia, are you okay with how we've left things at this point?
Well, has the group decided that they're actually going to do that?
Is there any other discussion on this? All right. I think that is how we will move forward, is we will make sure that we will either have a consensus recommendation, or we will vote on any response from the Water Planning Advisory Group back to the Implementation Work Group on any work products Implementation Work Group that you've asked us to review.
This is Carol Haskins. Has that report actually been sent out to the full advisory group?
Yes, it went out. Gosh, that was early. It might have been May or June, Virginia, and it's already gone up to the Water Planning Council. And they're taking a look at it now. They won't make any decision on it until probably the next meeting.
And, well, that was the – what went out many months ago was the draft. And then after the comments came in, that was revised. And so what went to the Water Planning Council was the revised version, which maybe you haven't seen. And also, I sent to Alicia and Josh the revised version, the two sets of comments that we got, and the group's response to those comments. And so that all went to Alicia and Josh, and it's your decision, Alicia and Josh, whether you want to forward that to everybody else.
The white paper that's gone to the Water Planning Council?
That and or the comments that were received and our responses to those comments.
Okay. Yeah, we can send all of that out together. Because I don't think anybody's seen the finished product after it came to us for review. Can you resend those to me again? Thank you.
Sure, I can resend that.
Just write this down so I remember. That's the other thing I need to send out. Anything else on this? All right. The other thing I wanted to bring up was the website. And I think I'm not sure where we stand on how. So I know when the website migrated to the new format, things were a little bit difficult to update. And I'm wondering where we stand on that, because these meetings aren't listed, or at least I haven't been able to find them myself on the Water Planning Council website with the date and the agendas. I know they're on the Secretary of State website, but Bruce, do you know where things stand right now and how easy it would be to make sure our meetings and our agenda are posted on the Water Planning Council website?
Sure. First of all, to anyone who went hunting for the agenda for this meeting, I thought I had posted it when it was final yesterday, but I didn't post it I apparently didn't post it until about 10 minutes before the meeting today. But more to the point, if you go to the water website, so portal.ct.gov/water, you see a site with a variety of things, and scroll right down the page.
Hold on, Bruce. Let me get there. Sure. So people can okay. Hopefully, you'll be able to see when I change screens here. Hold on.
Yeah, let me switch back to Zoom.
Sometimes it doesn't follow along when you click through. Okay, so you're seeing the Water Planning Council website right now, right?
Yeah, so this is the Water Planning website, and go all the way to the bottom of the page. And right. On the lower left, you see Water Planning Council, and you see meeting schedule.
Okay.
And if you go there, you will now find my preferred way to do these kinds of things. And I just this weekend finally got all the implementation workgroup stuff loaded in at the further down the page. What you've probably noticed in agendas lately is I try to include lots of links. So I put everything I can onto the Secretary of State website and then link to that from the agenda. So ideally, agendas include any documents that are being looked at. Sometimes the timing doesn't work out so well, and I'll throw some additional documents here. But in general, ahead of meetings, the agenda should have everything you need. You may not see that till the day before because a lot of things come in late, but that's the approach I take. Now, the Water Planning Council part of this is not me, so that'll be a little different, but I've been trying to handle the advisory group and implementation groups' agendas in that manner.
Thanks, Bruce. I'm sorry. That's not the way I tried to get there. Can I just... If there's a way, let's see. So if I went to work groups and committees, is there any way to just provide a link maybe here that would bring you back to that other page? Because I think that might be where people might try to go first to find the information about the meetings.
Yeah, that sure is something I can do. And I just this weekend started trying to make better sense of this. So I will absolutely do that. I will try to find every plausible place someone might go looking for meeting information, because there are at least three, now that you pointed this out, where people could reasonably go looking. And I will steer them all back to the page where I'm putting everything.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Sorry to make your life harder, but I know this new website has been a little clunky for everybody. So.
Now that will make my life easier, and I should have done it long ago.
Okay. Any before we move on from this, anybody have any questions? No? Oops, let me just check the chat, make sure that. All right. The other thing I just wanted to share, and I'm sorry I keep stop sharing and popping back and forth, but it's hard for me to tell where I am. This is kind of a fun thing that I hope you're all aware of, that Saturday is World Fish Migration Day. I just put a link in the chat if anybody wants to copy and paste to check it out. Usually it happens in April, but because of COVID and a lot of the people needed a time to adjust, because a lot of the activities that go along with World Fish Migration Day, like group paddles and visiting fish lifts and things like that, they had to rethink and cancel. So they moved it to October 24th. And keep an eye out for fun activities and information on migratory fish. I know Save the Sounds has put a lot out, and Rivers Alliance will be putting some information out as well. So
Alicia, if these migrating fish are considered immigrants, I'm disturbed that I haven't heard them in any of the presidential debates.
Well, we're trying to keep them on a low profile and out of his radar. Okay, with that, we've come to the public comment period. Are there any public comments? All right, I've got one. There's just a couple of things I brought up at the Water Planning Council meeting that I wanted to bring up to you guys. First, you know, we talked about stream flow earlier, and this is Coppermine Brook, right around Artisan Street. This is the same place that dried up. understanding we're in drought, but this is an over-allocated basin. And, you know, it's acknowledged that there's a lot more water taking out than this stream can provide. I did do a stream walk last week. And, you know, I think there can be a case made that, yes, there's probably some, this goes underground for some period of time. But the fact is, the entire stream itself, even though it's drought, it's quite low. And this one looks much worse than it did in 2015 when it dried up. So that is one thing I wanted to bring up. And again, this is just another instance where, you know, it is legal to dry up a stream in Connecticut and something we have to get a handle on. The other thing I wanted to bring up is we've had a few reports of tanker trucks, landscaping companies drawing water out of streams. And there's really nothing right now in our laws and regulations, aside from some the town ordinances, the inland wetlands regulations that are kind of wishy-washy on this. And one of the reports was from Tankerhusen, which is a wild trout management area. And, you know, aside from a resident coming to a local inland wetlands commission, there's really nothing that can be done about this. And this is another hole in our process where we should have a better handle on this. You know, if there should be some sort of cutoff, you know, when stream flows are below the 25th percentile, especially in a high quality stream, that we should be prohibiting these sort of activities. So there's just something else I wanted to bring forward, another drought related issue. And that's my public comment. Anyone else?
Yeah, I just have one is I'm pasting a link to the information that was part of a workshop that the Connecticut Council on Soil and Water Conservation did on October 16th. The workshop included presentations from the drinking water coordinator at EPA, as well as the Scott Berry, who's with the, the Alliance for, I'm trying to think, it's the AWWA, American Water Works Association. And he did a presentation on the One Water concept for folks who are interested in that. So I'm posting the link, and you will have that, and you can go to the website. And I know some people were able to join us, but it was an overlap with the Working Lands meeting, and I know some people were involved in that, so didn't get to see all of it, but it's all posted now on the Connecticut Council website, so people can go in and take a look at that. So there's both a video of the entire workshop as well as the PowerPoint presentations from the different presenters. Eric McPhee from the Department of Public Health did a great job on source water protection, so there was a host of really good presentations.
All right, anyone else? All right, do we have a motion to adjourn?
So move, Karen.
Hold on, Mary, I wanna grab your comment here because I'm interested in.
Yeah, so that was, here, I don't know if I can show you the picture. Let me, I've got the picture right in front of me. This guy. Yeah, so now he's not drawing. It was just yesterday's paper. Oh, that's not going to work.
Okay.
The way
I'll,
that.
Actually, I have yesterday's paper, so I'll find it there. Thank you.
On page one, section two of the current. And yeah, so.
Okay.
And then it says for a visual story, so there must be more to it. Yeah. So yeah, now he's only trucking in 18,000 gallons a day. I mean, that's just crazy, right?
All right, thank you. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry, we adjourned the meeting and then I me to go longer. All right, guys. Thanks everyone for your contributions and for attending. And I'll see you. Let's see. The next Water Planning Advisory Group meeting is on November 17th. The Water Planning Council meeting is on November 3rd, and the Implementation Work Group meeting is on November 10th. So, see some of you then. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.